Sigmund Freud lived until 1939, but he was, in many respects, a 19th century man, born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, educated in the rigorous Middle European way, getting a medical degree in 1881, entering a field of inquiry, the workings of the brain, the nervous system, and the personality, still at that point shrouded in mystery. This 19th century man, like that other Middle European who made a big splash, Karl Marx, is credited with being one of the architects of the 20th century. Marx and his heirs put their imprint on the external world, while Freud left his stamp inside our heads. This is from An Outline of Psychoanalysis by Sigmund Freud. We've arrived at our knowledge of this psychical apparatus by studying the individual development of human beings. To the oldest of these psychical provinces or agencies, we give the name of id. It contains everything that is inherited, that is present at birth, that is laid down in the constitution, above all, therefore, the instincts which originate from the somatic organization and which find a first psychical expression here in forms unknown to us. The vocabulary, id, ego, superego, association, defense mechanism, the unconscious, it's handed down to us by Sigmund Freud, not on stone tablets, but from inside our heads, and yet the jury is still out on the work of Freud, the scientific value of his research, the verifiability of his theses, whether anyone treated by this doctor was helped, was healed. Why remember Freud? As the Library of Congress gets ready to open a much-delayed exhibit this hour on the program, Frederick Cruz joins us from Berkeley, California. He's the editor of Unauthorized Freud, Doubters Confront a Legend, and the author of The Memory Wars, Freud's Legacy and Dispute. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here, Ray.
And Jonathan Lear is in the Chicago Bureau. He's the John U. Neff Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago and a member of the Committee on Social Thought at the university, author of Love and Its Place in Nature, a Philosophical Interpretation of Freudian Psychoanalysis. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And Jonathan Lear, why don't we start with you? Maybe you could say a few words on Sigmund Freud's behalf.
Well, I don't think I really want to speak on his behalf.
Well, let's say speak up for Sigmund Freud.
Well, let me speak up for things that I think he stands in a tradition and that goes on and is a very important one to, I think, keep alive. I think Freud stands in a tradition and made important contributions to the idea that humans are creatures that have unconscious mental processes, that they have a side to their life that is has meanings in them and for them, that people live through these meanings, often don't understand them, and as a result can live out certain what he calls fantasies, certain that the mind is imaginative and active in ways that are not transparent immediately to the mind itself. And I think what Freud really did contribute to this is an idea that goes back a long way and continues, but I think that two things that Freud very much contributed to this tradition is the idea, firstly, of how these processes work, that they're really, he comes forward with a theory of just the nature of unconscious mental processes. And the second, I think, is a therapeutic ideal, which I think, you know, Professor Cruz, along with others, have criticized how he actually practiced psychoanalysis. But he set an ideal of freedom as freedom from one's own, from tyranny of unconscious meanings. And I think that is an ideal, as a therapeutic ideal, as opposed to an ideal of, let's say, happiness, personal happiness, is a very important goal that he set down as a therapeutic goal.
Well, now that he's been dead almost 60 years, a lot of what we say about Sigmund Freud will increasingly be conjecture, as those who knew him in life will be increasingly no longer with us as well. But he does leave a formidable paper trail. And do you find that what some of the things that clinicians say, some of the things that scholars say, about the quality of his work, as it can be understood through his writing, leaves a lot to be desired.
Well, there's room to criticize the man, certainly. And I think, you know, a fair amount of research over the past 25 years has valuably come up with different sorts of criticisms of both the man and his practice. I think that the question is the exaggeration in both directions. I mean, I think a generation ago, Freud was being idealized beyond all recognition in terms of the man in this country. And I think there was quite a healthy reaction of, you know, sort of undermining these sort of godlike idealizations of a man who can just see into your unconscious and whatever. But, you know, the flip, I think there's just been a flip side to that. I mean, idealization very easily flips over into attacking disappointment. And I think that the, you know, conversely, I think that the criticisms have gone too far in the other direction. I think it's the same tendency to idealize a generation ago is now being expressed as a tendency to detract and diminish unnecessarily. I mean, this is a human being with... you know, with had made mistakes, had, you know, certain faults, whatever. I mean, so does everybody. And, yeah, I mean, just by quick comparison to, you know, I've been reading this biography of Newton. Nobody really, you know, his legacy isn't contested. But this is a man who, when you read the details, I mean, firstly, spent most of his intellectual life working on alchemy, trying to turn, you know, think about how to turn lead into gold. He solved the issues of gravity actually rather quickly in terms of his intellectual career, and was involved in all sorts of skullduggery around the Chancellery of the Exchequer, where he served time. I mean, but this is not important. Indeed, most of his beliefs about gravity we now think of are false. I mean, we now believe we live in a Einsteinian, Max Planckian type of world, not a Newtonian one. But we don't use those sorts of either personal facts or mistaken facts about his own science to criticize him. We use it to locate him within as part of, you know, what it is for a human being to make a valuable contribution.
Well, Frederick Cruz, let's bring you in here. Are you and your colleagues in effect setting your lances to do battle against a banner that no one's even flying anymore?
No, I think the banner is flying for sure. I think Freud still remains tremendously influential. And a lot of people who've never even heard of Freud are rehearsing Freudian ideas without knowing it. I think we can all agree Freud's influence in our culture is very pervasive and eminently worth study. The real question here is not whether Freud as a person had virtues and vices like the rest of us. Of course he did. The question is whether his system of thought checks out, whether it has an empirical foundation. Newton's mechanics still work extremely well if we get beyond the atomic level and below the cosmic level. And they can be independently checked, and on the whole, they look pretty good. The same cannot be said of Freud's system of thought. If one goes to independent researchers, those who don't already have a prior commitment to psychoanalysis, and asks, are any of these ideas, and I do mean any of them, independently corroborated in a way that makes them superior to rival possibilities, the answer appears to be no. So what we have here is a scientific and medical fiasco created by a man who is immensely charming and immensely influential.
Yeah. Could I jump in there?
Sure.
I think that much of what Professor Cruz said I agree with, except his conclusion. I mean, firstly, I think that there is a very serious issue about whether this is a system of thought that checks out and whether there are or how there could be independent ways of verifying it. The idea that, though, I mean, I think that the issue there is that trying to verify unconscious mental processes is a very difficult thing to do. I do not think it's impossible, but it's a difficult thing to do for two reasons. One is that what you're trying to verify is something about people, and in particular, something about the meanings that people live by. And it's very hard to know when how to test those things. It's very difficult. And secondly, of course, we're trying to measure and find independent tests of meanings that remain largely unconscious. Now, those are because we're trying to find out and actually do objective tests about the subjectivity of people. it's very complicated to figure out how one can do independent tests. But it's not true that we know that it's impossible to do that. And in fact, some of, I think, the most distinguished neuroscientists today, two I know of, are thinking very hard about how we can independently corroborate various claims about unconscious mental processes. And so, what I think the place I disagree with Professor Cruz the most is when he just sort of goes to, his use of the word fiasco, which is what he said. It's as though we already know everything there is to know about how we can test these hypotheses. I think that's very far from true. We're just beginning to learn about how the brain works in a very sophisticated way. And the idea that that we've already shown that there's no independent test of this is I think just untrue. What I think is completely correct and very important is that independent people, scientists, do try and work out ways to corroborate and disconfirm these views. I mean, it's not that I certainly don't think everything Freud said was correct. I think a lot of things he said are incorrect. I mean, even from the point of view of just looking at people as I do. But the idea that this is just a totally untestable hypothesis by objective science is false.
Well, Frederick Cruz, can it be true that that Freud was a breakthrough thinker and also wrong? We're not still kicking poor old Ptolemy's corpse around, even though he was wrong. We just say he was tremendously influential on his times. The universe that he posited was one that had tremendous appeal for people at the time, a harmonious set of relations between heavenly bodies. But, hey, none of it was true. But he couldn't see beyond his own world, and certainly Freud couldn't see neurons and electrochemical balances and couldn't see many of the things that we know today about the brain.
Ray, what you say is absolutely correct, and yet there's a great irony here. Freud was trained as a neurologist. He was on the cutting edge of research into the relationship between the brain and mental disorders, but he threw it all over, and he threw it all over for this meaning system that Professor Lear speaks about. And I want to say something about that. We are told that it's difficult to test the accuracy of unconscious meanings, but let's be more specific about it. What was unique about Freud's psychoanalysis was that he claimed that mentally suffering people were producing symptoms which could be decoded. They had interpretable meanings. This was a kind of poetry. So that, for example, if a patient was lame, or if a patient had a cough, or if a patient had stomach pains, or was constipated, all of these things had psychological meanings. Now, this is a claim that eminently cries out to be tested, because if it is wrong, then we get a whole lot of misdiagnosis and malpractice and, frankly, quackery. There's a new book, I'm not going to plug my own book, Unauthorized Freud, but there's a new book by Edward Dolnick that just came out called Madness on the Couch, Blaming the Victim in the Heyday of Psychoanalysis, that goes into the specific consequences of our general acceptance of Freudian theory for the understanding of syndromes such as autism or obsessive compulsive disorder or even schizophrenia. And it's an absolute horror tale. There has been tremendous social damage caused by the pursuit of ideas which are almost certainly erroneous. So this is why this is not just an academic matter. It's a matter of social welfare.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with almost everything that Professor Cruz has said. The main danger on the other side, I mean, that there have been terrible abuses, or that that human suffering has been caused by assuming a theory is more general than it is or has more general applicability than it has, is certainly true, and it's a very regrettable fact. The other side, though, is to throw out all of a theory, including the parts of it that may be true and may help mental suffering, because there have been exaggerated claims in the past. And the issue about mental suffering being symptoms that can be decoded, I mean, there's an issue about whether that's always and everywhere true, as opposed to that's sometimes somewhere and importantly true. And the more restricted claim is, I think, something most people believe. I mean, most people understand and interpret themselves, and I don't think mistakenly, that they can have, you know, like a nervous tummy. This is the idea is they're feeling a physical symptom and understanding it as the expression of a psychological state. Now, psychoanalysis is an extension of those sorts of physical feelings and offering interpretations just like we do in everyday interpreting of ourselves. And I think, you know, that's why so much of, I think, psychoanalysis are things, I mean, whether people want to or not, they already believe it. I mean, just to take...
Yeah, but Jonathan, Leon,
let me just finish. Okay. Let me just finish one point, and then you can go at it. But, I mean, we, for whatever, very interesting, complicated, and I think psychoanalytically significant reasons, we have over the past 10 months learned an enormous amount about the president's sex life. And when we actually look at the details of what happened, I mean, unfortunately, it's hard for anybody in this country not to have been exposed to a kind of very graphic, detailed account of what this man's sexual behavior was like. It's hard not to look at this and think, well, you know, there's meaning here that can be interpreted.
Well, the meaning, Professor Lear, that you gave to it in your recent article in the New Republic was, in part, that the whole country is suffering from its unconscious adherence to Freud's myth of the primal horde. So Bill Clinton, according to your article, strikes us as the primal father who has monopolized all of the females, and he must be killed because of this. To my mind, this is a wonderful example of the kind of depth that we're talking about here. It's deep because it's a factor identified as such by Freud. But how explanatory is it?
Well, thank you. I mean, one of the things I'd like to say firstly that something that very much interests me is that there is a very important discrepancy, as far as I can understand, by reading and trying to understand the polls, between what the American people, as they are polled, how they are responding to this crisis, and how editorial writers, news commentators, those who express in public fora outrage about what's going on are... there's a very important difference between these two sets of two groups, and I was really writing about the group of editorial writers, commentators, people in Congress who I think it's a very important political fact about the time we are living in that the American people seem to be willing to tolerate a much more nuanced view of their leaders. Where they're willing to accept that they do things that they don't approve of in sexual, personal realms. They don't do things they don't approve of even in legal realms, and yet they don't want that doesn't mean that they want this man removed from office, that the political is – they're willing to accept a nuanced and complicated view of a leader. Whereas by and large, those who express in the public domain have been expressing outrage seem to be moving from, on the one hand, I mean, I watch a sort of generational flow from, I think, you know, really the time of the Vietnam War and Watergate, where before that time, I think there was a tendency in the media to idealize leaders and suppress facts about that might impugn their reputations, to you know, a model of needing to attack and diminish and attack idealizations. Now the question is, you know, what kinds of attacks on idealizations are going on now? And what I do suggest in this article is that there are lots of things when you look at this crisis that don't add up in their own terms. That's where unless you get puzzled by what's going on, then of course there's not going to be any need or call for a psychoanalytic or any other kind of depth explanation. It's only when one finds things that are puzzling. Now, I find it puzzling, and I think a lot of people do, that You know, so for instance, Kenneth Starr has said that we, you know, the point of this investigation is to show that nobody is above the rule of law. And yet, you know, it's quite obvious to everybody in the country that Clinton has been treated in a way that no ordinary citizen would be treated in the law. So that's like, how is that possible? How is it because also, I mean, I find it extraordinary that the men and women who are serving the president as guards are suddenly turned into spies, and that that's sort of all right with the country. That this is something.
I don't want to get too much further down.
No,
this
but
road,
what I want to say is,
you know, called to talk about this.
Yeah, but it's when we get to you have to get. I won't go on about it, but I just want to say it's when we get to these sort of puzzling things going on that we then have to look for questions of like what's not on the surface that might help explain it.
I couldn't agree more, but the question is, what does the primal horde have to do with this, or what does the primal scene have to do with it? Because that's another element in your article. You know, when we find that things can't be readily explained, we should all look for other explanations. But the real bottom line here is, what virtue does a Freudian style of explanation have over all of its rivals? And that, I think, is very difficult to answer.
Frederick Cruz is with us from Berkeley, California. Jonathan Lear is at NPR's Chicago Bureau. We're talking about Sigmund Freud and what to make of his life and work, now some 60 years after his death. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our number is 800-989-8255. Glen Cove, New York is our first stop. Hi, Martin.
Hello, my name is Martin Wayne in Glen Cove. And I just want to say that my new book, if I can mention it, Freud's Answer, shifts the discussion away from this tired ground of whether Freud was right or wrong and moves it to the new ground of psychoanalysis as a cultural therapy. What Freud was doing was stabilizing Western culture, even though his theories and his therapies were completely ineffective for individuals with mental illnesses.
Okay, tell us a little bit more about how he was doing that. How was he stabilizing Western culture?
Well, what was happening at the time that he was working, at the end of the 19th century, Europe was falling apart. It had lost its morality, it lost its religion, it lost its God, it had labor conflict, international conflict, political conflict. What Freud began by doing was to reconstitute Christianity, and he did this by calling it psychoanalysis. He reconstituted morality through the Oedipus complex. He reconstituted the family of psychotherapy, and he counted the enemy and alienation of people at that time by focusing on the individual in treatment. Even though masses, millions and millions of people, were never in treatment, an idea was spread that there was a great interest in individuals and in their depths and in their feelings and in their meanings, and there was a lot of comfort in that.
Yeah, I think that certainly I agree with Martin, if I may call you by your first name, that dealing with Freud's, the person is tired ground, and what is important is dealing with psychoanalysis and its significance. I have to say I don't agree with the claim that it's completely ineffective for individuals. I just disagree with that. But, the more from my point of view, important point is understanding what legacy he has for the culture as a whole. And in that sense, I think, you know, I find myself in quite a lot of agreement with what you were saying.
Frederick Cruz?
Well, yes, I too agree that psychoanalysis has functioned as a kind of secular religion in our time. It has an idea of original sin, namely infantile sexuality. It has a confessional, the psychoanalytic experience itself. It has a tragic dimension, but also a utopian, redemptive dimension. I think all of these things have to resonate in our culture considerably. I'll just say, though, that I don't think the question of the empirical basis of Freud's ideas can be called a tired question. This is a question which has nothing strictly to do with Freud's biography. It has to do with whether or not the rules by which psychoanalysts arrive at their interpretations and hypotheses and the rules by which they purportedly confirm them are adequately disciplined, are adequately skeptical. If they're not, then I think we need to take a look at the entire system of thought from beginning to end. And if it should turn out that none of these ideas were either arrived at or corroborated in a scientifically respectable way, we may have to reach an extremely negative judgment about the whole thing. It's not necessarily extremist to do so.
If somebody had a raging infection and you gave them an antibiotic and it wasn't really an antibiotic, whether it worked or not would not be a tired question. Martin in Glen Cove, New York, thanks a lot for your call. This week, a long-anticipated exhibit is opening at the Library of Congress devoted to the life and work of Sigmund Freud. Today we're talking about Freud's life and legacy and why his theories continue to stir up debate. Joining us now is Sophie Freud, the granddaughter of Sigmund Freud and professor emerita at Simmons College School of Social Work in Boston. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Ray.
Well, a career as long as your grandfather's certainly has plenty of room in it for chapters, rising and falling of different ideas. Toward the end of his life, was Sigmund Freud reassessing his own work from 20 and 30 and 40 years before?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's sometimes forgotten, that he kept changing his own mind and having new ideas, let's say, about anxiety and its place. And so that people who are so bound on engraving his ideas in cement are really not following his model.
Well, by the end of his life, certainly by the mid-30s, he was already widely celebrated, and his methods and understandings of working with disturbed people had worldwide reputation. What did he make of himself at that point in his life?
What did he make of himself?
Yeah, I mean, you don't just, get up and look out the window and say, boy, it's Wednesday and I'm Sigmund Freud.
I think he was very pessimistic about life in general, and with good reason, considering what happened soon after he died. And he was even pessimistic about the treatment that he had invented. I think inside his soul, he worried that it was not a very effective treatment, and said so now and then.
Or perhaps not as effective in the hands of other practitioners?
Well, I don't think he felt that it had been that effective even in his own hands, I suspect. But he wouldn't have said that aloud.
And your own work, as you grew to adulthood and struck out on your own career, how heavy was the burden both to watch the reassessment throughout your life of your grandfather's work and to also have a sense of responsibility?
My burden was that I would say that the benefits I've had from having a famous name that opened a lot of doors were greater than the burden. But people expected me to be loyal to his ideas, and as I grew into adulthood, I questioned some of the ideas, which have been a problem for me, because being disloyal to one's own family is not viewed favorably in our society, or at least what people think is being disloyal. I would not define it that way.
Well, certainly Sigmund Freud's disciples who are not his family would probably not look too kindly on perceived acts of disloyalty.
Yes, and my own family, some of the members are not that happy with me, but I feel I am loyal to many of his ideas, but there are some gross distortions in his views that I have spent time looking at because they interfered with my own growing up, let us say, his ideas about females and women and female sexuality and woman as other and what does she want. And I don't know if it was a waste of time, but I did spend a lot of time thinking about these things and sometimes writing about them.
Would that be where your largest single disagreement would be with Sigmund Freud's work?
That is one area, and his drive theories strike me as very outdated and no longer useful to our new understanding of how the brain works and has its own energy, so it does not need to be fueled by drives. But I'm not a severe critic. I see Freud as having had many postmodern ideas and having been a pioneer in, let us say, viewing the self as being divided rather than unitary, or the inventing a talking cure. Now we are talking about narrative therapy, which is not that different from telling one story and hoping to improve it in the telling.
No, that's a good point. That is seems very fresh when you hear about it again.
Yes, but it's you could view psychoanalysis as that kind of process, and I suspect some people do view it that way. So I see it as a continuation of his ideas, the postmodern narrative therapy, or even the emphasis on meaning-making, which has become so central in the human sciences, was anticipated by Freud, so that, you know, that people above all want to make sense out of their experiences and try different ways to make sense. And I think Freud's ideas, or especially the idea of the unconscious, were so popular because it gave people one more way of understanding irrational behaviors, especially their own.
Sophie Freud, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sophie Freud is the granddaughter of Sigmund Freud and professor emerita at Simmons College School of Social Work. She spoke to us by phone from Lincoln, Massachusetts. My guests for the remainder of the hour are Frederick Cruz, editor of Unauthorized Freud, Doubters Confront a Legend, and author of The Memory Wars, Freud's Legacy in Dispute, and Jonathan Lear, the John Neff Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago and author of Open-Minded, Working on the Logic of the Soul, and Love and Its Place in Nature, a Philosophical Interpretation of Freudian Psychoanalysis. Our number is 800-989-8255. Chicago's next. Barry, welcome.
Yes, hi. A couple of comments, listening and enjoying the guests. I think Freud should be remembered, perhaps best, also in the light, not only the era that he made his discoveries, but in some very important things. Namely, one of the things he discovered was the fact that emphasized in his theories, were the ideas that what happened to us in childhood affected us as adults. And that concept has remained probably central in almost all forms of talk therapy. He also invented talk therapy, which I think is another critical element that we need to keep in mind when we remember Freud. I think there will be many theories that will come and go, and certainly Freud, I think if you read him, as his granddaughter had indicated, that people were, he was constantly reappraising him, and he has been reappraised. But Freud also, I think Dr. Cruz had indicated, was a neurologist. I don't think he necessarily turned away from neurology, but he tried to put into words a form of psychobiology, if you will, and I think gave it a good shot. And he also made some, I think, incredibly good clinical observations. And I think probably his clinical theories hold up not so well, but his clinical methods might hold up a little better over time and his observations. And one final point is that, unfortunately, I don't think many people who are practitioners of psychoanalysis are probably as... I think their own narcissism around their love for their own self, they get very impressed with their own theories and their own ideas and become married to them rather than keeping a very open, critical scientific mind and get quite sloppy, I think, clinically and when they apply them to social or anthropological theories as well. So I think all those things might be kept in mind, and that's all I have to say. I can take my... anyone wants to respond to that off air.
Thanks a lot, Barry.
Okay.
Well, who wants to...
Sure.
I'll respond. Frederick Cruz?
You go ahead.
Yeah. No, Barry has said a lot, and I'll just focus on one thing, and that is the accuracy of Freud's clinical observations. One segment of my book on authorized Freud is about Freud's case histories, and there are several studies in there that go into great detail about the way in which Freud drew inferences about little Hans, about Dora, about the Wolfman, and so on. And let me just give you one example. Little Hans developed a horse phobia. He was afraid of horses, so afraid of horses that he couldn't leave his house for a while. Little Hans had seen a large horse fall down in the street and had been terrified. A normal, commonsensical interpretation of what happened here is that because little Hans saw a horse fall down, he became afraid of horses. This was not the way Freud looked at the matter. For Freud, the horse had almost nothing to do with this. What Hans really feared was his own desire to have sexual intercourse with his mother and his consequent fear that his father would castrate him for that. The connection with horses was very inferential and roundabout. According to Freud, Hans feared horses because horses move, and movement in the unconscious equals copulation, so that when Hans thought about horses moving, he thought about his whole constellation of Oedipal desires and castration fears, and that's why he developed his phobia. Now, this is very, very typical of Freud's mode of reasoning, and all I can say about it is it imports a number of counterintuitive assumptions that stand between us and the commonsensical interpretation. This is basically what Freud did in every instance.
Well, it's always the last part of what Professor Cruz says that I take exceptions to the in every instance. I mean, firstly, you can't. I don't know. You know, what we know about the clinical examples are given to us by Freud himself, and insofar as we can see errors, egregious intrusions, mistakes, whatever, it's largely due to Freud himself putting these views forward for criticism as well as inspection. And I must say, it was a delight to listen to Miss Freud. I think the points that she made, in particular, that Freud was always reassessing his own work. He kept changing his own mind, and he had actually quite humble views about how much could be done. I think all of that is absolutely correct. And I think, you know, my own sense, she talked about people expecting her to be loyal to his ideas. It sounds to me, and then was worried, she said that she was worried about being disloyal to one's own family, and then actually then slipped in that she, you know, that was what people think. In fact, I think her kind of reassessment is just the kind of activity Freud would have engaged in himself. Now, to the actual clinical examples, I'm not going to debate any particular point about little Hans, but I do want to say is that, you know, people, I think one of the facts that Freud is trying to draw our attention to is that people are not as straightforward as they think they are. And there can be very strange connections, things that on the surface look absurd and are actually very easy to ridicule, you know, if you just take them out of all context of knowing what else this is linked to. Now, I mean, you know, types of things that I, you know, I have trained as a psychoanalyst myself, as well as teaching philosophy. And sometimes you'll just see these people will come in and they will have symptoms. I mean, they'll have difficulty urinating in a public bathroom in a way that they just don't have any difficulty doing so when they're at home and they don't know why. And it's not a matter, it doesn't feel like it's up to their will. They don't know what's going on. Another person, you know, at about the time that a penis is going to enter her vagina starts to gag and starts having difficulty breathing. Doesn't have any idea why. Now, these are very odd things. And Freud's account of this is that people can sometimes make connections between ideas in their mind that don't make sense when looked at, but they don't even know what they're doing. Now, could this interpretive activity be subject to abuse? Yes, of course. And I think that, you know, I disagree with Professor Cruz in many ways, but I think, you know, the general tendency to say, hey, wait a second, what's going to constrain our interpretations? How can we know what we're doing is responsible and not just sort of irresponsible, flying away with whatever meanings we want? Terribly, terribly important question. But I think it's one that has to be addressed seriously and not just used as a way of dismissing the whole realm of thought.
Doug writes, whether or not Freud was lastingly right, such concepts as projection and ego and unconscious are currently useful, and Freud pioneered the way for the use of these concepts across society. 100 years or 200 years from now, we may regard Freud the same way we now do the alchemists, but it seems the alchemists were necessary predecessors to the chemists and other scientists that have provided the foundation for our current technological society. We may regard Freud as an alchemist, or we may regard him as similar to Newton. Evelyn writes from Salem, Oregon, as a psychology professor, I make sure my students are aware that despite the lack of empirical support for most of Freud's theories, his ideas continue to have profound effects on our lives. From a developmental perspective, Freud was one of the first to proclaim that children should not be treated as little adults. His ideas regarding the mistreatment of children and how that can influence normal psychological development were fundamental. One has only to look at the number of laws that protect children from abuse, as well as laws protecting children from entering the workforce too early, to see his influence. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go next to Portland, Oregon. Naomi, welcome.
Well, everyone's just about said what I'm going to say. I mean, I was a psychology major, and I've also been in psychotherapy for many years, and I'm very proud of it. And all I can say is certainly Freud's psychosexual theories per se, plus and Oedipal theories, et cetera, have done a lot of damage as far as uncovering sexual abuse is concerned. Yet, if it were not for his concept of the unconscious, the concepts of the defense mechanisms of, you know, suppression, repression, denial, projection, all of that, I mean, we wouldn't be uncovering the abuse that we suffered as children in the same way. I mean, without psychoanalysis, we wouldn't be there. So when I tell people that I'm in psychoanalytically and humanistically based therapy, you know, in psychoanalysis, it's important to differentiate between classical, you know, psychosexual theory, you know, drive-oriented psychoanalysis, and the more ego-psychology-oriented psychoanalysis that is more contemporary. And in that sense, I'm very proud to be in therapy that is primarily psychoanalytically oriented and where both my therapist and I are feminists.
Well, Frederick Cruz, Naomi mentioned that we wouldn't be uncovering some of the things about our earlier lives that we are without some of Freud's concepts. Some of your critics in the collection, Unauthorized Freud, take up that very point and say, boy, maybe it would have been better if we weren't uncovering some of these things because they didn't happen.
You're absolutely right, Ray. And I don't know whether Naomi is in a recovered memory type of therapy, but I sincerely hope that she isn't. Freudian ideas have allowed therapists since about 1985 in this country to imagine that the so-called memories that they have extracted from patients of having been sexually abused as children are veridical memories. They do so using the same assumptions on the whole that classical psychoanalysis uses, the belief that sexual trauma is more important than any other kind of trauma, the belief in repression, the belief that we can accurately de-repress memories, the belief that we can't make ourselves whole again unless we remember the infantile past, and on and on. All of these ideas were derived from Freud. I think that on a theoretical plane, psychoanalysis bears a very heavy burden of responsibility for what's happened, and it's really been a national disaster over the past decade and more.
Well, Professor Cruz uses words like disaster.
We only have a very brief amount of time, Jonathan Lear.
Well, I'll just say I think that's among all the things that Professor Cruz has said today, that's the most false. The psychoanalysis is, with Freud's discovery of unconscious mental processes, is the, I think, one psychotherapeutic discipline that has called all the principles of the recovered memory theories into question. And I think that just is completely false.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Naomi in Portland, thanks for your call. Thanks to everyone who called and wrote this hour. And thanks to my guest, Frederick Cruz. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Ray.
Frederick Cruz is the editor of Unauthorized Freud, Doubters Confront a Legend, and author of The Memory Wars, Freud's Legacy and Dispute. He joined us from KPFA in Berkeley, California. Jonathan Lear, good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Jonathan Lear is the John Neff Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago and author of Open-Minded, Working on the Logic of the Soul, and Love and Its Place in Nature, a Philosophical Interpretation of Freudian Psychoanalysis. He joined us from NPR's Chicago Bureau. Earlier, we heard from Sophie Freud, the granddaughter of Sigmund Freud and Professor Emerita at Simmons College School of Social Work. She spoke to us by phone from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Well, you don't have to delve into the dense tomes gathering dust on people's library shelves to understand Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud is also quite a player in popular culture as well. Here, he even had a cameo in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Therefore, Ted's father's own fear of failure has caused him to make his son the embodiment of all of his own deepest anxieties about himself. And hence, his aggression transference onto Ted.
Wow.
Okay, Ted.
Yes. Thank you very much, Sigmund Freud. Nah, just got a minor Oedipal complex.